On today's episode of Be the Husband She Brags About podcast, we welcome in Lane Ballone. Lane is a curious explorer, harmonious creator and storyteller. He's the co-author of Unleash Your Humble Alpha, host of Exactly What the Moment Called For podcast, and creator of The Joyful Sovereignty Experience. So guys, from that intro that you're after listening to our guest today, Lane Ballone, it's self-explanatory why I'm personally pumped to have this opportunity to just go deep with Lane. Lane, you're very welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, brother, for having me.
Lane, there's so much of me. There's like this inner child part of me. You know, there's this part that's like, I want to know about the Green Beret experiences, all of that type of stuff. Like, that's sort of like the geek out cool stuff. And, you know, obviously what's come after that, Unleash Your Humble Alpha, the book. Yet part of Deep Men's work, and I know the guys listening in, it's always deeply impactful to sort of vicariously learn from a man's story of origin. You know, the boyhood memories that carved out the character or planted the seeds, the experiences and challenges that you had to overcome in earlier days. I'd love to start there just to give guys a background to the man that has emerged that speaks before us today. In researching, in preparation for speaking with you today, it came out in one of the podcasts, your early years. It was a single mom family. I believe you spoke to the first year, if for a portion, if not for the whole lot of it, you were homeless for that period. And between the ages of 2 and 3, you can confirm that for me. I think you moved like 11 times. That's a pretty dramatic introduction to life in this physical form. Could you kick us off there? You know, just maybe you don't have direct memories of that, but yeah, what meaning has that brought up for you as a man, and how has that impacted you those early years?
Yeah, so I've done a lot of deep work on that over the past few years, especially on my spiritual path. And really what it's offered me is a beautiful element and aspect of humility for my life. And if you could just imagine, like, you know, wherever we come from before we get on this planet, you know, for some reason, I put myself into these really difficult situations as a very, very young human. And, you know, the first 7 years, roughly, you know, we're in this more theta state. We're in this receive mode. We're a sponge. And that means that we're both energetically, physically, mentally, emotionally absorbing everything that's around us. And basically, it's helping us understand this experience of life. And it's the people that are around us, the environment. And so having the first, you know, several years, you know, homeless, in a homeless shelter, living in a, at a lake in Arizona with my mom. And then, you know, later on we moved, you know, all those times in the next year or two. And so that, life of uncertainty, that life of lack, that life. And because if you could imagine just a young human just soaking in the emotions of these other humans, parents, people around that have somehow found themselves not in the best situation in life. And that's how I started. And so, you know, throughout my upbringing, you know, I had a lot of love for my mom and sister, and that really helped kind of shape this other side of me that even though I might've felt a little bit of lack, a lot of uncertainty, I still felt a lot of love, and that love overpowered that uncertainty and that lack. And that didn't change the whole time I was growing up through, you know, up until high school, until I left the military. You know, we didn't have a lot of like material things, but we had a lot of love. And so, you know, that whole period of growing up offered me just this really, it anchored me to humility for what I'm becoming and what I'm to become for the rest of my life. So it's a beautiful reminder for me that no matter where we all come from, that we can, you know, dig ourselves out. We can move forward. We can allow the old story to be an old story and not have this cyclical experience of, I'm going to continue to experience lack. I'm going to continue to experience uncertainty within myself, even though the environment might be uncertain. So yeah, that's how it started.
Thanks for sharing. And it obviously speaks to a really profound relationship with the feminine in your life, you know, the love for your sister and for your mom, and just that beautiful feminine aspect of, no matter what the physical materialistic lack was, there was that feminine container, you know, holding you, that loving, radiant container. And my curiosity is, obviously, you know, there's no dad in that story. Where was your dad? What was your awareness of your dad at that period?
Yeah, so he wasn't around the whole time I was growing up. And I think I interacted with him once or twice. I think when I was about 12, he had sent me some kind of like care package kind of thing with a note and a piece of art and some paper. And because he worked at a paper factory. And so for me, I didn't really know it the whole time I was growing up, but I kind of locked it and suppressed it, you know, and stuffed it down. And I didn't really deal with it. And I really just kind of covered it up and thought everything was all right and didn't express my emotions. I had moments of expressing anger and frustration and like, why does he not want me? Why is he not around? You know, these kinds of feelings that, you know, any young boy could have. And these are gifts with the right perspective. And we can talk about, you know, the gifts later. But yeah, it definitely, you know, destroyed my confidence. It didn't really allow me to feel like I could go to a single person to confide in, to say, hey, you know, fathers or mentors to their sons by default. And whenever you don't have that, it feels like you're just kind of like grasping, because there were leaders around. I was in Boy Scouts, which was great. I was in athletics and I had coaches, and those guys were great influences on my life. You know, we were part of the church. And so I had male leaders and figures that were supporting me, but it was always kind of not stable. You know, it was always like wispy, and I almost had to learn how to grab what I could get from, you know, masculine leadership. But later on in life, we can talk about it later, but it was a true gift that I use today. And, but it also gives me a perspective on me as a leader, you know, and who I can become, you know, so.
And I know you mentioned there sort of was like sort of wispy, and like there wasn't maybe one stable masculine presence there. Who played that first sacred role? As you know, most guys, and I've spoken with so many guys, I haven't experienced it myself. You know, my parents stayed together. I had my own traumas, my own issues within that container. As you know, it's like we're all going to be traumatized in some level, no matter what, you know, with the society we live in, etc. But I know speaking with guys where parents have separated, normally, like I found most guys will speak about that one guy. It's like there's the first masculine role model that you're like, okay, things change when I met that guy. It's just that masculine modeling of discipline, directionality, and all the multiple beautiful aspects of masculinity. Who was that guy for you? Who's the first guy that in your story, if you're writing your autobiography, you're like, okay, there was all these other guys, there's lots of appreciation, but that guy, there was something unique and special about.
Yeah, so there was probably about two or three, but the first one was a guy named Kevin McGlasson, and he was part of the church. And for some reason, he just connected with me and took me under his wing. And it was for a good period of time. We did events, and like I grew up in Oklahoma. And so one of the things that we did with the church was, you know, a men's retreat or like a father-son retreat. He took me. And, you know, some of the things that we did was like cow patty throwing and, you know, all these kinds of like really country things that you do in Oklahoma. And
there's a part of me feeling a bit more normal coming from rural Ireland. Like, I mean, cow shit throwing, that's okay. So that's normal in the States and in parts as well. I'm feeling
in some
way
parts,
more normal,
yeah.
Way more normal and maybe even a bit cool about my childhood. Go on.
Yeah, it was definitely not the whole thing, but yeah, we definitely did that. Yeah. But it was this, it was not so much what he did, but he did some amazing things for me, but it was this kind of energy that he brought about genuine care. And he like made me feel special. Like he took the extra time to like sit down and listen. And, you know, it was the small things of bringing a gift or going out of his way to invite me to do something. And it was just these like, oh, like I'm special kind of thing. And so that was, you know, he really brought that kind of awareness to that type of relationship, specialness and care, purity of care. And so that was definitely one of them. And then another one that definitely want to mention is my Boy Scout leader. When I was, you know, 12 years old up until, or actually before that, I was at the Cub Scouts, then Boy Scouts, you know, so it was a way for me to get out and do, you know, some outdoor stuff and get around guys and stuff. And Kenneth Ware, our Scoutmaster, he also just had a special uniqueness to care about young boys and their upbringing, about camping, outdoor stuff, Boy Scouts, you know, all this kind of stuff. And he was a very stable leader for much of my growing up, you know. So yeah, those two were big ones for me.
Then, well, that's maybe not the next phase, but what's jumping out at me, like from a masculine leadership perspective, it's obviously the military, your experiences eventually as a Green Beret. But there was a part there again in the research, I burst out laughing when I heard it. I was like, I have to just touch base with Lane about that. Did I hear you correct that you made the decision to get into the military as a teenage boy or whatever year you were, from rock, paper, scissors?
Yeah. So, that's definitely true. And, my buddy AJ, him and I were like, what are we going to do after we get, you know, high school, you know? And, he was more familiar with like military stuff, and I had no idea or anything about military. And he's like, hey, have you heard about the Army Rangers? And I'm like, no, I don't know what that is. He's like, oh yeah, it's cool. I was like, yeah, I was thinking about, you know, we should do, you know, college. And he's like, I don't know about that. I was like, let's do it together, you know, cause it's always better to do something together than by yourself. So anyways, we did rock, paper, scissors, and basically it was like, okay, we're going to do three times, you know, best two out of three. And so he ended up winning and we both joined the military. He actually couldn't join, like as we were joining, he actually had to wait extra 6 months because he had cancer. And at the time, I don't know if it's still a thing, but you had to have 5 years remission of cancer before you could join the military. So we were going to join together, but he had to wait like six more months. I joined in July. He joined in December, I believe. And, but yeah, he's still in. And, has an amazing career. Very proud of him. But yeah, you know, it was just like, you know, allowing the fates to decide.
Yeah, I laughed out loud, and it just brought up a lot of reflection for me when I heard that, because like on one level, it's like, what a process, you know, it's like rock, paper, scissors. And yet at the same time, you know, I thought about my own process. I was like, wow, you know, I remember going in and it was like, you know, there was the career guidance counselor and it was like, what do they call it? Like the psychometric test, and like 40 or 50 questions, and then the print off. Oh, I think you'd be suitable for this, suitable for that, suitable. And I eventually went into physiotherapy. But it's like, I might as well have done rock, paper, scissors, you know, because there's this part. And I know later we'll talk about, I feel one of the core things that jumped out of me in Humble Alpha in that approach was the foundational focus on identity. I think there's going to be a natural thread. We'll come back to it. But it's like, I know me as like a 16, 17 year old when I was doing those, like, the fuck did I know about my identity, who I truly was? And, you know, this system that goes, oh, well, you know, we've designed these questions and we're going to, you know, slot you into this job, which, you know, if you stick with it, it's going to play a substantial role in your life. I mean, it is as ridiculous as rock, paper, scissors. So I actually came away going, I fucking love that process. There's almost a part of me is like, I wish I could go back to my best mates and go rock, paper, scissors. You know, it's like,
yeah,
it's a cool story. So okay, you come from, you know, you're exiting, I suppose, teenage years and entering adulthood, and you have your beautiful, spontaneous process, rock, paper, scissors. You decide upon the military and you go with it, and you just go with life, as so often it is, like the Taoist teachings. You just go jump into the stream of life. From the initial phases, and please enlighten my ignorance, because my knowledge of the American military system comes from an upbringing with my dad looking at films, you know, masculine macho films. So in my ignorance, do I pick up correct that you do general army training first and then the Green Beret is specialist training, or what way did your first few years look like training wise, and how did that progress?
Yeah. So when I joined as a different job. I was 17 years old and I thought I was joining a job that was a little bit cooler, but I had no idea. I joined as a intelligence analyst, and I thought I was going to be gathering intel on the ground or something. I don't know what I was thinking. I was 17. So the first, you know, I had my basic training in South Carolina, and then I had my advanced individual training in Arizona. And that was about 8 months or so. And then after that, I went to my first duty station. So I had no idea about anything about special forces, special operations, or cool guy stuff. But about, you know, the first couple of weeks as I was in advanced individual training, AIT, I was like, this is like more like computer stuff and like map stuff and, you know, coordinating things. I was like, oh, this is not what I thought I was going to be. Like, but I'm going with it. So it was pretty cool. It was fun. It was, I was actually learning how to learn, because academically in high school, I was pretty lazy. And because I was smart enough to get by without doing a lot of homework and stuff, I, you know, didn't do awesome in high school. And I definitely didn't learn how to learn very well. But I was, you know, having fun, sports, Boy Scouts, you know, that kind of thing. And in AIT, I learned how to learn to a degree. And so after that, I went to my first duty station in Germany, which that's where I wanted to go, because I wanted to travel, but I didn't really know it yet. I had this kind of yearning to travel and explore. And I was really blessed to have Germany as my first duty station. And so I was in Germany for a year and a half eventually. And then I got there in February, and then December is whenever I found out about special forces. So up until then, I was like, you know, doing everything that I could. I had a lot of fun. I was like the youngest person in the division. And then I just like said the Army Creed in front of the whole division, you know, on the Army's birthday. It was like, you know, super fun being just a young guy. But I felt this like, there's like something more challenging, you know, and that's what I was feeling. I was like, this is like a little bit easier than I thought it was going to be. And I kind of just had this yearning to explore and to be challenged. And that'll be another, you know, story of my life kind of thing, you know, that will be repeated. So I saw this poster on the Shopette, you know, convenience store door, and it said Special Forces, you know, come check this out kind of thing. And it was in December. I was like, oh, okay, cool. This sounds like I wanted to I want to check this out. And so a couple of days later, I go into this old auditorium, you know, 1940s auditorium. You enter from the back, and then there's all these seats, and then there's this projector. It was playing this video of like dudes falling from the sky, shooting big guns, like on four wheelers, and, you know, all this really like blowing stuff up. I'm just like, oh my, that's the Army I thought I was joining. I was like, man, that, like, you know, to a young boy, like, that's the coolest thing you could do, like, especially in the Army military realm. And I remember being there, and then I just said, yep, I'm just going to go for it. I don't know what it is. Like, I had no idea what Special Force was or anything. And after that, I just said yes. And then I started training to go for the selection process. So the 24-day selection process, and, you know, grueling mentally, physically, emotionally. And I started training. I was just wearing a rucksack with like 40 pounds on my back everywhere I went. for the next couple of months.
I'm curious within that, and there's a part of me personally is like, I think I've overheard about Navy SEALs at this point. I'm actually really glad personally. I was like, okay, there's a Green Beret because I want your voice heard. No, there's super cool guys, David Goggins, Jocko Willink. There's many others. And there tends to be a lot of Navy SEALs that are bringing their wisdom. In that 24-day selection process, what are the most grueling challenges that were set before you? I suppose, what was the most challenging for you personally that you remember, just to give myself and give guys listening in, because not many guys at this point, you know, it's like military training, I know in Italy and many different countries, sort of like a bygone era where it was like an obligatory thing. So not many guys actually really know what that on the ground experience is like.
Yeah, so that whole period of training, you know, the Special Forces qualification course, including the selection process, for me was a initiation. It was initiation to warrior. And during that 24-day process, I had several different ways that just really challenged me. And the first one was almost everybody that was there, there was like 350 guys or something. Almost everybody was there was infantry or combat arms or something, you know, more hardcore. And I was here, I was this intel analyst going in. And so that was one mentally like, oh, should I even be here? Because then there was guys that had been there before to selection. And they were like, oh, this is my second or third time. I'm like, whoa, this must be pretty tough. And there were, you know, all these stories of like, you know, only, you know, 1 or 2%, you know, that sign up for selection actually go through the whole thing and then earn their Green Beret. I don't know how accurate those percentages are now, but it's fairly close to that. And so that was mentally, I was like, oh man, should I even be here? Like, I'm not even good enough because I'm not combat arms, I'm not infantry. And then another aspect was team week. Because I was so young, team week is all about solving problems and being a leader while solving problems in a very high stress situation. And so they have all these like different activities to where they'll give you like a bunch of stuff. They'll give you like a pole, some wheels, some heavy things, some like rope, some stuff to where, okay, we're in the middle of the sand and we got to get this broken, unassembled thing and we got to go that way. And you got to lead it. So you have this small team of dudes that all don't know each other. We're getting to know each other, all different backgrounds. And then say, hey, you're the only guy that can talk. And you have to tell everybody what to do, how to put this thing together, and then we move forward. And not only was it very, very difficult to actually put the thing together, that as we were moving it, like as an example, like we would be given a pole and one wheel, and then the other side would have to be guys uplifting that thing as we're moving something heavy down the road in the sand, right? As an example. And what it was for me is like, oh, like I haven't been in that kind of leadership position because some of these guys have been in combat, you know, at the time. And some guys, you know, have had like military difficult, you know, experiences. And I hadn't had a combat experience yet. And that was a really difficult thing for me to step up and you know, speak and lead, especially in a high stress situation. And then especially during one of those periods or one of those activities, it was another thing where it was called the down pilot. And basically we had like two poles, a stretcher, and then we had a 500-pound bag of sand or a duffel bag of sand. And basically it was simulating like, okay, we got to get this pilot out of here. And it's a enemy territory. We got to move, right? And it was so, so heavy. And at one point, you know, we have, you know, probably six people or five people, or maybe it was at least five people because we had four people on, you know, one on each corner, and then we were rotating. And so one guy would get like about 20 seconds of rest because it was so heavy. And then we'd rotate out. And I remember this one point where one of the guys, it was so heavy for him that he just fell. And it was the rest of the three corners, me and two other guys, had to bear that weight and offset it, right? Mm-hmm. And so there was this moment of just like we were moving, and it was just like, oh my gosh, this is so like painful, it's so like And I had this like, it was almost as if time just like slowed down. It was just like, almost like a movie to where it's just like playing, just like everything super slow. And I was just in my head, okay, it's like, this is a moment where I could just quit. Or am I going to dig deeper and keep going? And up until this point, it was, you know, things were, you know, there's some difficult things. And it was like, okay, this is a moment where I'm going to keep going. I'm just going to give it my all and allow myself to just see what happens if I give my all. And so when I look back on that, especially, it was a highly charged, highly energetic, highly emotional moment that basically kind of locked in a belief system of like, always keep going, never quit, you know? And eventually, like, we kept going for the next like 5-10 seconds. It was such a long 5-10 seconds. But eventually that other guy, you know, recovered and helped us out. And then we kind of stopped for a second and, you know, we eventually kept going. So that was for me, a really critical moment of, you know, locking in, you know, something about myself.
It almost, you mentioned that was an initiation, you know, at the beginning of that story. It almost feels like energetically, you know, there can be these moments. I think every guy that speaks of the word initiation, there can be this one moment or many moments, but there's unique qualities about them. There's just some mysterious, almost mystical shift that happens. It feels like that, as you were describing that, like, oh wow, that was the initiatory moment. What age were you at that point, having this experience roughly?
I think I was 18. Wait, this is 2007. Yeah. So I think I was 18 or 19. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. What an incredible experience to have, you know, as an 18-year-old. When I think of myself, you know, it's years later, you know, I met men's work in the last 3 or 4 years, and that was highly charged for me. As you know, second half of my 30s, life's experience, you know, being married, had kids, there was a lot of initiatory pressure moments for sure. But my initiation with men happened at that point. There's just this part of reverence, and just hearing you speak about that in the presence of such powerful men, would obviously, you know, I'm quite sure the instructors were ex-commanders or, you know, high-ranking guys coming back in to be at that level. Yeah, to be in the melting furnace of that type of pressure with that masculine presence, unlocking, judging, criticizing, and then the far side supporting you, you know, that masculine presence, like there were two other guys with you. It's like, you know, that was a shared experience. Like you didn't all drop. So yeah, I'm actually feeling really pumped and alive just vicariously living that. If I'm following well, that's still within the 24 day, the selection criteria. Did you surface victorious in that selection criteria? And okay, you're nodding your head there. It's like, what was it? What I'm curious about, Lane, is can you place words on what it was in you, this fresh guy, you know, doing the analytical type work? You hadn't been, you know, in the, if you want to say, like the rugged military arena like the other guys. But what was it about you with your freshness? What was the characteristic in you coming in? Or maybe what was the character, the part of your character that emerged in those 24 days that had you get out the far side when other guys were coming back, you know, repeatedly not getting through? Just what did you discover in yourself?
I think from a macro point of view is that Special Forces, the Green Berets, are all about you earn your Green Beret every day kind of thing. And a lot of guys that didn't make it, even though that they may have been more physically stronger, you know, had more stamina, could run faster, all that kind of stuff. There's a mentality that they didn't need to earn it again, that they, it should be handed to them kind of thing. Not a slight thing of entitlement, but not that kind of strong, but so it's like It's like, hey, man, I've been to combat. You know, hey, I'm an infantry guy. Like, I deserve to be here, kind of thing. And for me, it was like, oh, well, I don't know if I deserve to be here, so I'm going to earn it. I'm gonna go give it all I can in order for me to see if I get selected. And I think that having, you know, that humility, just, you know, to say, hey, I don't know if I am worth this, but I'm going to give it my all. Of course, there's some things I had to unlearn from that later in life, but that kind of unworthiness, or like, I got to earn my keep. I got to make sure that I give it my all, so that way I can reach the finish line. That's a powerful motivator. And for me, with fresh eyes, a beginner's mind, and before I had started thinking about special forces, my grandma came to Germany and we did a Euro trip. And there was this one moment where I basically had a experience at a restaurant, me, my grandma, and this older couple in Zurich. And we were having conversation, talking about travels, politics, the world, languages, all this kind of stuff. And there was this moment I just felt so small. I was like, I don't even know how to, I'm just listening. Like, I don't even know how to like contribute. I don't even know what questions to ask. And so that moment right there, like, shifted something within me and said, I got to start learning, you know. And I kind of alluded to learning how to learn, you know, in my advanced individual training. But this is where I really shifted into, like, started to, you know, consume personal development books and things like that. And so that's what, you know, that hunger for knowledge drove me to learn, like, okay, these guys in the infantry, like, learned infantry stuff, and the special forces learn the same thing, but they learn it in a slightly different way. And so I didn't have the bad habits, so to speak, of, you know, where if I was in the military for, you know, 10 years, I'd have all these like different ways to conduct. But I was just going fresh and I was learning and I was just in this mindset. So I think that's what allowed me to, you know, make it to the end and get selected. And then, you know, that helped me, you know, through the next 2 years of training, you know, to earn my Green Beret after that.
What's coming through me there, and you've already mentioned the word, you know, the humility. And obviously, you know, it's the golden thread there. It's like, became eventually humble alpha. It's just that humility to know where you're at, to accept that you're going to have to earn it every single day, and you got to get learning, you know, you to have the humility to accept where you're at, what you know, what you don't know, and many levels, the stuff you don't know, you know, the mystery beyond, that ground of humility. So at this point, you get through the selection process. There's already, it's an ultra intense test and challenge of your character as a man. You have this initiatory experience. Then you go on to the special forces. And I'm going to read out here, because this was obviously, it's going to be a reminder for you, because you know what the core mission of the Green Beret was. But for my ignorance, I was fascinated to actually get to know actually just what it was about. Possibly oversimplifying with a short line, but I'm trusting Wikipedia on this. And just to support guys listening in, just what that mission was. The primary mission of the Army Special Forces is to train and lead unconventional warfare forces or a clandestine guerrilla force in an occupied nation. First of all, I see your head nodding. I'm like, okay, when you go into Google and you go online, it's like you can... I didn't know what the source was. So you're nodding head. That sort of crystallized what the core mission and focus is for a Green Beret.
Yeah. So there's many different mission sets. At the time I was in, I think it was about 7, but I could be wrong. But yeah, there's different kinds. Unconventional warfare is the primary mission. And that's what differentiates us between other special operations forces like the Navy SEALs and other units.
Okay. Within that, there's this, I want to bring the golden thread of curiosity, but tie it back in with guys, you know, the guys listening in predominantly are husbands. They're in a high intensity zone. You know, this is, and I think part of actually the issue, I know for myself for years as a man playing the role, you know, showing up as a husband, I didn't actually self-acknowledge how brutally intense that can be, how lonely that can be. You know, I think it's, there's this part of that humility to go, okay, actually, this is really revealing of where I'm at and where I'm not at. And do I have that humility to actually own up? My curiosity, Lane, is, you know, you go into the special forces, you do the training. What did that teach you about how to show up under the most intense situations imaginable? What part of the training? And there's a part there where I think it's maybe a second part to the question is like conflict resolution. I imagine that you went quite deep into conflict resolution, how to navigate, you know, with great awareness. Yeah, speak to the first bit, you know, the training and the most intense challenges as a man. And maybe I'll circle back with the conflict resolution curiosity.
Yeah, I think it mostly had to do with taking a pregnant pause, taking a deep breath in a high stress situation. And then really just taking that deep breath, exhaling the anxiety, exhaling the chaos, and then coming back to a state of calmness. I'm like, okay, all right, what do we do next? You know, and I could think of, you know, several instances, and especially in the military, you know, you have these extreme examples of like combat situations or intense situations to where like something, you know, wild or chaotic is happening fast. And in order for us to move forward, taking that deep breath in and exhaling anxiety and chaos is like my default now. And it was kind of, it continues to solidify itself when I look back on different high stress situations. So for me, that's the first thing that I do. And then I ask myself, okay, what's next? Okay. And, you know, if it's, you know, a relationship situation, okay, you know, what do we really want here? Or what am I really trying to say? Or what is she really trying to say? And really just kind of get very present with what is happening and allowing that breath to be like this transmuter, this alchemizer of, you know, whatever the energy was before to, okay, what are we really trying to do here? And allow that little shift to neutralize the situation as much as possible. And yeah, so I'd say that's probably, you know, sounds very simple, but very helpful.
And it's in the simplicity of it. I find myself, you know, listening to podcasts for years and reading books, and there's a part of my mind that's like, oh yeah, but give me the strategy. Give me the, you know, the chapter long, or give me like the whole paradigm. And yet the simplicity cross-culturally, mystical traditions, spiritual traditions, you know, the army, your Green Beret, Navy SEALs, the breath, the simplicity, just one breath in, one breath out, and assess. It is that simple. I just like slowing down. I know, like, doing my breath work training really initiated me into the simplicity of that. It's just, I invite guys listening in, you know, in the octagon of marriage, in the octagon of all of those overwhelming needs and kids and money and wife, and you know, it's like it's an intense octagon. But just that, if it was the only thing that you took away from this podcast, you know, the guys listening in, that would be life-changing in itself. And you know, this is coming from the lips of a guy, Green Beret. You know, I'm what I'm curious about, Lane, is, you know, that wisdom in your time within the special forces, qualified, fully trained in the field, is there one moment that you were most challenged as a man? Like what one or two moments do you remember that for you was, wow, you know, the greatest challenge, but the greatest victory for you were, yeah, actually coming back to breath, take that breath, assess objectively, neutralize the situation. You know, that neutral, I love that word, you know, just bring it back, objectivity. It's just, there's no good or bad. Just neutralize it. What was one of the most intensely challenging experiences you had as a man during your time with the forces that you realize all of this training, this inner work, you know, where you prove to yourself, like, this shit works in a most astoundingly effective way?
Yeah, I consider my military career to be pretty in the special forces realm, pretty average, because I have a lot of friends that have been in much more extreme situations. And so, you know, I'm very candor about that dynamic. But there was definitely a moment where we were in Northern Africa and a situation happened that was unexpected. We got basically the camp that we were training on and working with was run over by a militia. And they basically took almost everything, anything that was worth, and they occupied the base. And as soon as we heard word about it, we were like, well, we got to go and check it out, you know? And so, you know, we were in non-military vehicles traditionally. And, you know, so we roll up and we go in the situation, and, you know, they're shooting guns in the air and all this kind of stuff, trying to scare us away. And it wasn't, you know, entirely, frightening, but it was definitely like, whoa, like, this is, it's almost like as if the world was collapsing on us, because we, you know, what we were doing there, basically just got, you know, destroyed and like just, jolted, you know, out of its normal, you know, thing that it was. And so right after that, it was like, oh, what are we going to do now? You know, like, are we safe to where we're staying? What is going to happen to all the equipment? What are they going to do with all the ammunition, the demolitions, all this stuff, you know, that they took? And it was like, man, like, this is a highly energized situation, very, very uncertain. And we were a very, very, very small team, you know, at the time. And, you know, less than like a dozen or about, you know, less than two dozen people altogether. And then it was only like less than a dozen of us Green Berets and in the whole country besides the embassy. And so we're like, we felt alone. We didn't know what the actual threat was, because this thing happened out of nowhere. Right. And so the next couple of days, you know, were very, very stressful, because we were on high alert, you know, almost up 24/7, just getting a little bit of sleep where we can. And then, What do we do next? You know, like, who do we talk to? You know, how are we going to recover this stuff? Like, how does the mission go forward? You know, what are we going to do? You know, because it's just like such a uncertain environment. And to contrast that with, you know, combat situations that I'd been part of before, prior to this, you know, when you're in combat, like, there's the first initial part of the campaign to where the forces are figuring things out. But oftentimes you have this large force, you know, to where we're strength in numbers. And then, you know, after this initial phase of, you know, Iraq and Afghanistan, as an example, they start to build up bases, they start to build up, you know, structures, logistics, systems. And even though it's still combat, you know, you're in this, you know, compound, and then you're going out and doing missions and very dangerous things, it becomes kind of like this thing where it's certain in a way, where like, okay, we're here on our camp, on our compound, we're gonna receive intelligence, we're gonna receive missions from higher, we're gonna plan for them, and then we're gonna go do them. We're gonna go do them, and then we're gonna come back, and then we're gonna eat, work out, hang out, right? This repeat cycle. So you get this kind of like normal cadence, even though it's a very extreme, very dangerous situation. So contrast with that kind of familiar combat to this, to where we didn't have very many, people. We didn't have a lot of support. And so if something were to happen, you know, it could get really dangerous. And we were, you know, in a country where something had happened, you know, several months before that everybody's heard about on the news. And so we were like, okay, well, we don't want to be that story, you know, of something happened like that again. And so, you know, all these things were real. And all of these moments, every single one of us were just like, all right, taking a deep breath. What's the next move? You know, and, you know, I'm so grateful for the people that we had, my team sergeant guys that I served with, you know, during that time, just incredible men. And just, you know, one of those things where you're like, man, I'm glad I have these guys. And like when you look in their eyes and it's just like, I got you, bro. You know, like, I have no idea what's happening. Let's figure this out. And that's, you know, the camaraderie that the military offers. And it's a beautiful gift. And it's like, whenever you're, it's that feeling that, okay, we got this. I don't know how we're going to figure this out. And that's also like a characteristic that I hold on to after the military. It's like, I have this sense, I have this feeling, and I have this way about me that it's like, hey, let's go do this thing. We could talk about boundaries and, you know, I'm not here to, you know, help you heal, all that kind of stuff, but like, fundamentally, from a very foundational place, I have this feeling of like, let's work this, let's figure this out, let's move forward, and let's not give up on each other. Mm. So yeah, that was probably a situation to where more unconventional than what you might hear from other Green Berets that have, you know, very intense and extreme stories. But this is my story, you know?
Yeah. Well, on a level, I suppose there's this point. It's nice to speak about a career that wasn't as eventful as some guys, because I mean, there's such, of course, it's to celebrate the heroics of the guys that come out the far side of those, you know, dramatic moments of conflict. Yet the unspoken side is there's a lot of guys don't come out the far side of those. So it's beautiful to write stories and, you know, create films about the heroics. But I know myself, like growing up, the romantics of, you know, the military drama around the planet, there's a lot, you know, you don't have it depicted where, yeah, well, for every hero on that battlefield, there was one mother and there was one, you know, a bunch of parents actually getting a knock on the door that guy did not come home. So yes, it's actually, yeah, it's honoring, and I'm happy on a level that you report, it was like, you know, it was an average experience out there. I'm quite sure that's a good thing in a way. It's like, you know, you served honorably, you did your service. But in moments like that, there's this part of me that comes in. It's like in moments like that, and I think this is the conflict resolution. What part of the skill set, and I'd bring this into, you know, I want to bring it into the marriage arena now, but there's a part where, you know, as men in marriage and in life, we can get addicted to the struggle. We can get addicted to drama. We can get addicted, be it at work or in relationships. It's like, you know. But actually, a happy life is an uneventful life. You know, I know in Tibetan Buddhism, they talk about, you know, like it's very ordinary. This enlightened state of being is actually very ordinary. You know, there's this Western idea of like, it has to be spectacular, and there has to be like a whole big, crazy, dramatic ride. And it's like, no, actually, it's just like a quite standard thing. So yeah, there's a part of me, intuitively speaking, is like, is it like the skill set of conflict resolution? Is it the skill set sometimes where, yeah, maybe there wasn't such a drama, but there was probably a lot of decisions made by you, by members of your team, that de-escalated what could have been spectacular, what could have been worthy of a film, but it wasn't. But because of that presence at the key time, key moment. The next wave was coming through me, but I really want to bring in, like, at what point, because I not knowing the chronologically where it happened, at what point did it's Alexandra, your wife, what, when did you meet, when did you guys meet, and at what point chronologically in the story, just to fill me in and the guys listening in, because it's captivating, this story of you, your earlier years coming into military, but at what point did your sacred queen come in the scene?
Yeah, so prior to the story that I just said, we had got engaged before that deployment, that mission. And we had met in 2010. And, you know, we met at a rooftop bar, and it was like kind of almost destined to happen. And we met and really connected. And then we tried to go on a couple first dates, and it just didn't work out. And I was just like, I was really awkward, and I was, you know, trying to be funny, but I wasn't funny. And, you know, and so it just didn't work out. And so then we just, you know, kind of didn't speak for about a year or so. And then something happened where, you know, both of our lives opened up again, and we were just like kind of ready for each other. And then we went on another first date at a sushi restaurant. And then just, it was the right time, you know? So we just started connecting and getting to know each other. And then a really interesting thing happened somewhere, you know, after we had, had that second first date several months later, you know, we were here in Colorado, and I was still in the military, of course. And I was on base working. And then my team was like, hey, let's go out to eat. Let's go downtown. And so I can't remember exactly why I had to take my own truck. They took, you know, other guys took another truck, and then I think I had to do something afterwards or something. And so anyways, I parked downtown, and then I park, and then I had to walk to the restaurant that we were going to. And then as I was walking this crosswalk, I noticed this debit card, and I was like, oh, someone left their thing. Right. And so I was like, oh, okay. So I picked it up, and then I looked at the name. I was like, you gotta be kidding me. It was Alexandra, you know, my now wife. Right. And I was like, oh my gosh, like, what are the odds of this happening? Right. And so I was like, oh, okay, well, I know where she works. She just works like, you know, half a block right there. And so I was just like, oh man, this is so weird. You know, like, cause I was awkward and weird at the time, you know, and I was just like, oh man, like, if I go in there and I give this to her, she's going to think I'm stalking her, or think I'm weird, or like, well, like, well, I don't know what she's going to be thinking. And so I was like, okay, well, I got to give it to her. So I go in, and I was like, hey, is Allie here? So that's her nickname. And she's like, yeah, she's in the back. You know, I was like, okay. And so like her friend, you know, coworker, you know, goes to the back, and, you know, I later learned that as she went back there, she's like, hey, is that guy that you've been talking to, you know? And I was like, it's kind of acting a little weird, you know? And she's like, yeah. I was like, okay. So then, she comes up, and then I act extra weird and super awkward. I'm like, I found this card in the crosswalk right over there. I think it's yours, you know? And she's like, you know, kind of like, this guy finding my thing, you know? And so now we laugh about it, of course, but it was like, if there was like this story that was like kind of like milestones of like, hey, like, you're going to have an experience. It's like, you guys got to make sure that you like really look at this relationship, you know? Like, I felt like that was kind of like a little breadcrumb from the universe of like, hey, check out this girl, you know, like really think about this one, you know? And so, absolutely, you know, I was like, okay, you know, that was a little hint from the universe of, you know, like, hey, check this one out. And, yeah. So then.
Excuse me. I'm laughing here to myself because it's just so funny. The context, you know, here you have, and it's just, it plays out the masculine, feminine, that secondary, you know, male, female, and that sacred dance. But, you know, I can't help but find the comedy, But the true grounded reality of, you know, how much of a challenge that is for us men, you know, the irony of, here's this green beret trained masculine being that is trained to, like, in one breath, you know, just be decisive and, like, has been tested and initiated. And yet it's like, it's the sacred feminine. I mean, it drops us in, it brings us back to humility. It just, that's like this divine dance. And it just shows this importance. I just couldn't but notice, like, this incredible thing. We you know, from the outside, it sort of seems, you know, and there again, how it's portrayed. It's like, the unstoppability of the military, the unstoppability, but it's unstoppable within one arena. The training is within one arena. And yet, you know, this is a different arena, the masculine feminine dance, and just how there's another deeper layer of fear that comes up for you, Green Beret trained, but for every guy. So yeah, just that contrast, I just find it humorous just to see with the level of training and that human experience still at the core of it. How did that evolve beyond that? So you had this sacred moment, the universe sort of put you guys together. When did you know, okay, this is my gal, this is my girl? How did that unfold?
Yeah, so we just continued to get to know each other, and throughout the next year, we were just, you know, boyfriend, girlfriend, and getting to know each other and connecting. And then it was kind of forced in a way to make a decision, because basically I was going to go on this mission. And then shortly after I returned, there was going to be a period of, you know, refit and all this kind of stuff. And then I was going to be slotted to go to a new duty station. And so I was going to go to Germany, or I had a choice, but I was going to go to Germany. And in order for us to continue our relationship, you know, we had to be married. And so it was just like, the universe kind of just like, okay, now is game time. Okay, what are you going to decide? You know? And it was just like, you know, and it may not be the best story. It may not be the right story, right way, but that's just how it happened. And, you know, but we just like thought about it. Like, well, you know, if we don't get married and we just allow these next 3 years to be what it is, you know, her being in Colorado, me being in Germany, me going on missions, you know, all the time. And that's what happened. Even when I was married, you know, just didn't see how the relationship can move forward meaningfully. And so basically I was like, okay, I'm going to do it, you know? And so then I asked, you know, her dad, and that was an interesting conversation, but he said yes. And then I was basically going to propose on a hot air balloon. And for a while, she didn't believe me. Like, I had to like rope my mom into like vouching for me, because basically, like, it was like coming, like, I was getting ready to go on this mission. And it was like weeks prior. And she's like, well, like, you know, we talked about, like, are we going to do something after this? You know, like, are we going to, you know, and like, now's kind of the time, buddy, you know? And you know, weekend by weekend by week, you know, was like, no proposal. And she and her friends were like, I thought you guys were going to, like, she's like, yeah, but you hadn't asked yet. And what was happening was that I was going to do it over like a Saturday and on a hot air balloon ride. But for like 2 or 3 weeks, like, the winds were just like not having it. Like, I was like, oh, like, well, try to have this like picturesque, like, cool proposal, you know? And then, you know, it was like, well, it's down to the wire, you know? And I was just like, okay. And I remember my mom lived here at that time. She moved away, and then now they're back. Now she's back. But she lived there at the time, lived here at the time. And I was like, hey, I gotta go, you know, drop something off by my mom. Can you come with me? You know, and it was like at night. But basically I was trying to get her out of the house without making it seem like, you know, like something was about to happen, you know? And so we, you know, knocked him up, you know, hang out with my mom, and then drop something off or whatever it was. And then we go through the back roads of, like, here in Colorado Springs, Garden of the Gods. There's this balancing rock. It's basically like huge rock, and it's just like bouncing on this little nub, basically. And so it's nighttime. We're driving through there. She's like, well, what are we doing here? You know? And then, it was, you know, just a very like kind of haphazard kind of proposal. But, you know, I just got down on one knee and, you know, gave her my heart. She said yes. And then we ended up going to a Brazilian restaurant and celebrated. And it was kind of funny because, like, that's how I proposed. And then, like, for some reason, as a joke, like, I wrote, like, on a, like a sticky note or something like that, like, will you marry me? Circle yes or no. And then she circled yes. But, like, that's like, and we posted it on social media, like, to kind of like tease it. But, like, a lot of people thought that's how I proposed. I was like, oh, no, it was a little bit more. I mean, you don't want all the story. Like, it was going to be really, really cool. But now it's just kind of cool, you know? Oh, but yeah, I'm very nervous. And, you know, of course, you know, like every guy's, you know, proposals, you know, life changing and in some way or another. But yeah, so that's how the proposal happened. And then very, very shortly after that, I left for that mission. And, and so that was also a difficult time of navigating our relationship, you know, in a very intense mission and things happening. And, when I left, I told her, I couldn't even tell her where I was going, you know. Eventually, like throughout that period of time, I was able to, let her know like where I was at. But, when I left, she had no idea where I was going at all, what continent. And, because we couldn't tell. And so that was, you know, definitely a challenge that we had to go through initially, you know, before we were even married. And but yeah, we, every challenge that we've been through, and, you know, there's a lot of different, you know, challenges, you know, that we could talk about, but it's like, you know, we all grow at different paces in different ways, and we have our own individual journey. And then we have this, you know, collective, you know, journey together as a relationship. And, you know, being able to navigate our own individual challenges and also the challenges that we have, because both her and I were very unaware at the time. You know, luckily we had, you know, a really strong, pure love that connected us. But we've been put through, you know, the ringer of, you know, our own doing on both of our sides. More so on my side because of the hardness of the military and the drinking and the need to like kind of like have a mission. But I had to, over the past 5 years, you know, since I've gotten out, I've had to really unravel that aspect of myself and really heal those masculine aspects. So we can talk about that.
I think it's coming in beautifully. I know Peru ended up being an instrumental place that you visited. First, there's what did your relationship with Alexandra, your marriage, being married, how did that impact your decision to eventually leave the army from a marriage, intimate relationship perspective? Because I know it brings up a lot of stuff within myself and with a lot of guys. You know, how do you honor your own mission, your own job, your own pursuit? But there's this inarguable link with this loved one beside you. And, you know, there's a clear influence. And I don't think a lot of times, this is why I find it's really important in the podcast here, is to speak to that unique dynamic, because so many podcasts speak to, oh, the Green Beret or the Navy SEAL or the Olympian. And it seems like it speaks to the individual journey. And there are individual challenges, but there are so often for me, there's always this part of like after reading a book or listening to a podcast, I'm like, this dude is married, but like, how did he navigate those conversations with his woman? How did you navigate, you know, like there's this major part of the story. So if you could speak to your decision to leave the army, this, you know, this incredible chapter or several chapters of your life, but speak to it through the lens of the meaning that your intimate relationship with Alexandra, how that impacted the relationship, and the relationship impacted the decision.
Yeah. So when I look back at my life, there's some very simple main themes, and one is harmony. And in my career with Special Forces, it was a very extreme, very awesome, very adventurous, very, very thrilling experience for me. And it really tapped into the masculine of purpose, of mission, of directionality. And it's really easy for me to just slip right in there because that's who I was. At the time, I had this yearning to like do something else. And even before I got out of the military, I started my little, you know, side hustle called Increased Freedom. It was about, you know, using travel as a tool for transformation experiences. And I was secretly wanting to grow that. So that way, whenever I got out, like I could just kind of like, okay, well, this thing's kind of becoming successful. I can make money, or I'm making money. Well, that didn't happen. That's a whole nother story. But I had this yearning of like doing something else. And then there's this other dynamic of where I was in this very critical window of time in my military career, to where I was at about 12 years. And basically at about 12 years or so, like you have to decide if you're going to stay in, because up until that point, you're signing up contracts of 4, 5, 6 years. And, you know, you get a bonus and you might get a, you know, school or something like that every time you do that. And whenever I joined, you know, I was like 4 years or so. And then whenever I agreed to become a Green Beret, I had to extend out because they basically like, you know, wanted to, you know, squeeze the juice out of me for all the training and money that they put in, you know, for me. And so then I was just going like 3 or 4 or 5 years or so, you know, and at this time when I was in Germany, I was like, okay, this is coming up. Okay. Like, so if I sign up again, I'm going in, you know, they call it in depth. And so basically like for the rest of my, for 20 years. Right. And I was like, oh man, like that's, you know, do I really want to do that? You know, do I feel like I have something else to express? And at the same time, there was this dynamic of, in order for me to be a great Green Beret, most Green Berets that are great at their job have a very bad family life, because they're putting all their energy and effort, and that's the priority of mission. Lives are on the line. I'm, you know, protecting my unit, you know, when I go out and all this kind of stuff. And it's very kind of like serious. Of course, there's a lot of play, but it's this very mission orientedness. And so I was like, okay, well, if I'm going to do anything, I got to do it the best of my ability. And I was doing it to the best of my ability, but it was to the detriment to a certain extent, because while I was in Germany, like I was gone at least half the year on training missions, trips, training, all this kind of stuff. And it was taking a toll on our relationship. And I was like, well, I don't want to, that's not how I want to be. You know, that's not the kind of husband I want to be. And I was like, well, if I continue down this path, there's going to be likely more of this for like 8 more years, 7 more years. And I was like, well, that's not how I want to be. That's not who I want to be. And so we were talking back and forth, like, you know, what do we do? And so basically like, you know, through those tough conversations of, you know, how do we move forward together as a couple, as a relationship, as a husband and wife? And really the only choice, if we wanted to do it right, was to get out. And, you know, so that was the choice. And then once that choice was made, it was like, oh man, like, how do I leave something that I love, you know, that I'm really good at, that I have a lot of fun with, because I love learning. I love going out and exploring in new places. And I was like, man, this is really tough. And then, so it was the relationship and then my own personal purpose, you know, outside of the military, like what was I going to aim for next? And when I got out, I was just like, I have no idea what it is. Like, I think it's this travel thing, but you know, it's entrepreneurship's really tough. And that's a whole nother topic. And I just like, I didn't know. But I was just trusting my heart that this was the right thing to do. And so you know, I'm sure I disappointed a lot of guys, you know, especially my team. But, you know, it's just everybody has their choice and everything. But I knew that was the choice that I had to make to harmoniously move together as a couple, as a family, you know. So we ended up getting out. And then once we got out, we went back to the U.S. And then we did this really beautiful road trip across America, 37 states over 3 months, and just really connected again, especially that first month. And
I love that trip, because I know they're listening to the podcast. You put that down as like one of the most positive things that you've done in your life. I think the question was, oh, the deepest challenge and the most, and you named that trip. What was it about that trip for you as a man and Alexandra as a woman coming together? What was the deepest significance for ye as a couple doing that trip together?
Yeah, so before we did that, we had done many trips in Europe. We did a lot of traveling. And I think we visited 20-something countries together, a lot of it in Europe. And we were able to like go out on these explorations and trips, and it was really, really fun. But then when we got out, we were able to do it on our own terms. It was like we were unbounded. We were unleashed to be a couple, to be free, to go wherever we wanted to go, like on our own terms. And so, you know, we created that, you know, kind of route to visit family and friends and everything, but it just felt so liberated to like, we don't have to report back to Army. We don't have to tell anybody where we're going unless we want to, like going to visit people that we want to see. We're going to places that we want to go to. And it just had this like very liberation feeling, this very free feeling. And that allowed us to really connect on a very present level, you know, because it's like whenever we have a very structured life and there's a lot of boundaries, there's a lot of restrictions, like it feels like that we're, like we only have this very narrow channelization of like being and doing. It's like we could only go on trips whenever I could take off, or, you know, I could take off quite a bit, but still it was still like that, like compressed kind of like feeling, bounded. And then like everything was just lifted, you know, during that time period. And it was really just that us feeling freedom together, us feeling like present together and not worrying about, you know, the future, not worrying about what used to be. And so that was a really beautiful moment for us to connect. And of course, what I later learned, much later in life, just like a year or two ago, is that one of the reasons why I love travel so much is because I'm in the state of presence. I'm in the state of like, what is that? You know, because I don't know. I wonder how that came to be. Like, I wonder what that tastes like. You know, like, why is this place like it is? You know, like, what? Out of all the things that happened in like previous present moment in the universe, like constructed this country, this city, this location, this natural formation. And it just really puts me in this beautiful state of presence. And I didn't know why I loved traveling until pretty recently. I was like, oh, it's because I was present. I was wholly there. I wasn't thinking about the future. I wasn't thinking about the past. I wasn't nothing. It was just like, what is here? And there was these like little flavors of like the textures of the present moment that like lingered and like wondering about the past and stuff like that, but it was very, very present. And so we got to share that presence together as we were exploring these different places.
I'm noticing there's a part of me, I do always come in with a sheet and it's like, you know, let's go with that. There's a part where I'm getting captivated. I want to go in even deeper there, yet there's beautiful chapters to speak to in shortly after leaving your service with the Green Berets. You went to Peru. I know that was a pivotal moment in your life as a man, and from which I don't know if it was in the first trip, if there was like one trip or several trips, but I know that's actually what birthed Unleash Your Humble Alpha. But could you speak to what inspired your initial trip to go down to Peru the first time, and why Peru was so instrumental, or has been so instrumental on your path as a man?
Yeah, so Allie and I, we, especially when we were living in Europe, we had this kind of Trello board of like all of our kind of bucket lists. And we kind of segmented into different places that we wanted to go to based on continent and all this kind of stuff. We still have it. And while we were living in Panama, we're like, oh, we got to explore a little bit of South America. You know, like we're here, it's closer. And so Peru is always one of those places, especially Machu Picchu, you know, just pulls, you know, pulls you in. And so we were there for a while, We were only there for a year and a half in Panama, but somewhere, I have to remember the exact dates, but, you know, we were like, oh yeah, Peru, like, you know. And so eventually some friends of ours, they had went to Peru and then they came back. And then we went to lunch with them and they were telling us all about their experience with Machu Picchu and Ollantaytambo and Cusco. And it was just like, oh man, like I'm feeling it, you know? And so we're like, let's go. All right, we got to go, you know? And so right after that lunch we had, we just went back to the apartment and we booked flights. You know, I looked at the schedule because I was in, I was taking college course, you know, with Florida State University. They have a campus down there. And I was like, okay, well, when's the window, you know? Like, and so we booked it. And before that, though, earlier in the year, my business partner, Steven, co-author of Unleash Your Humble Alpha, great guy. He had posted in a veteran entrepreneur group called the Vetpreneur Tribe. And he had posted in there and said, hey, I just got back from this masculine awakening ceremony in Peru. And, you know, this and this. And if you're ever interested, you know, just let me know. And I was like, whoa, like it called me. And so that was before. And so I had hit him up. I was like, hey, so tell me about this. And he kind of explained a little bit. And he's like, hey, if you know, so whenever you, you know, you go head down to Peru, I'll link you up with these people. And so I was like, okay, cool. So I reached out to him after we had booked flights. So, hey, we're going, let me know. He said, okay, hey, here are the Meibergs, you know, reach out to them and they'll take care of you. And so we took care, you know, we took care of the itinerary. And then somewhere along the way, I noticed there was a thing in there that said Wachuma ceremony. And when we first planned everything, like I had no idea what it was. And it was months later that we found out like, okay, Wachuma is a plant medicine. You know, it's a San Pedro plant medicine. And I was like, oh, well, that's not why we came. But, you know, like I wasn't looking for it. I had never heard of ayahuasca or plant medicine or anything like that. Didn't know existed really. And then I was just like, oh, well, okay, I guess we can, you know, if it's part of the thing, you know, because I initially thought it was like this, you know, like a sacred ceremony thing, but no plant medicine or anything. And so long story short, Steven was able to come and bring a couple other people and we actually made it a bigger group. And it wasn't just one ceremony, it was three. and we also, you know, had of course the Machu Picchu experience. And that was basically the opener for me. And it was just really this beautiful expansion of awareness, knowing more about myself, and allowing these sacred plants to assist me in my own healing, in my own expansion of who I am. And from that point, you know, it was just like, okay, this is going to shift my life for the rest of my life. You know, this is like a, you know, this is a story, or it's a part of my story where, again, I'm stepping into the unknown, you know, joining the military, had no idea what it was, and then joining, and then hearing about special forces, have no idea what it was, and then going for it. And then the spiritual path, you know, have no idea what it is or, you know, what I was going to get myself into, but going for it anyway. And such a pivotal, you know, moment for me. And, you know, that really awakened the feminine side as well. And I've been working on that ever since.
You took the words out of my mouth. I had that query because I know you've written about that and spoken to that several times. The awakening of this feminine or remembering of your feminine side, and you sort of nudged towards that earlier on, you know, like the career, the work hard, ultra masculine focus, mission oriented, you know, like to an extreme level, but like a beautiful sacred level, that warrior archetype embodying that. So, but then there's the, you know, the drinking and the work hard, play hard sort of element to that, and the challenges that that brought up in marriage, in relating obviously with the secondary feminine in your beautiful queen. The cracking open in Peru, and since then connecting with the feminine side, how has that changed your capacity to show up as a husband, as that masculine conscious presence, and do that dance with your divine queen?
Yeah, so in remembering the feminine aspect of myself, I've also been able to heal the masculine wounds. And doing that within myself, of understanding the direction that I'm heading towards as an individual, but also as the direction, you know, way shower to a certain extent with the masculine energy in the dynamic of husband and wife. I've continued to lead, but now I'm able to integrate the feminine of, okay, how can I help her activate her masculine directionality? How can I support her in her journey, and you know, allow to have us to have a differentiated life, to where like she's going to do her music and I'm going to support her, but I'm going to do music, but not to the degree in which she is, you know. So she's in a band and she playing cello, she works philharmonic music, right? And being able to create the container for her and also create the container for myself, and navigating this balance of leadership, but also integrating the not doing anything, right? It's the whole kind of like, you know, dynamic of like when the wife wants to tell you something, you're not trying to there to fix it, right? So how can you just be there and just support her and just listen, right? And so it's been definitely a huge struggle for me to integrate that feminine side, that beingness, but her having the capacity and the will and the love for me to allow me to work through my stuff, and then vice versa, you know, we're holding each other's space for our own individual growth. But it's this kind of, it's the same path, you know, we're walking, you know, on just some different little parts of the cobblestones, you know, but we're still on the same path. And sometimes, you know, we're locked arms, holding hands. Sometimes we're, you know, locked even tighter, you know, synchronicity and step. And sometimes we're, you know, checking the roses over here. And she's checking, you know, so it's like, you know, we have this room to breathe and be ourselves. But we're still on the same path. And it's really just, I would say that the biggest thing that's helped me is just having the intention of integrating the masculine and feminine. And if you have that from a macro point of view, life will give you everything that you need. And so this is, you know, basically like you can set intentions in a masculine way or a feminine way. And I'm setting intentions in a masculine way is a precise, a directional, detailed intention of where we're heading, what we want, that kind of thing. And then the feminine side of intention creation is this really openness of like, I'm just going to receive what I need, you know, like, it's just like, you can't really define it. You can't really like choreograph it. Like a masculine intention and a masculine direction is like defined. It's tangible. Oftentimes you can hold it in your hand, but then like the feminine side is like this elusive, like, well, I can't really like define it. I can't really say, you can't define like good things are going to happen to me every day.
I had a conversation with my queen Matilda there yesterday, and we both burst out laughing at the end of it. But I forget what, like, she came with, I forget the exact language, but it sounded something like, hey, there's something I want to talk to you about. I don't really know what it is about, and I don't really know, do I want to act on it, but it's there and I want to talk to you about it. It's like, and I burst out laughing, but it's like that part. It's like, there's this masculine part. It's like, you know, tell me destination, tell me the issue, tell me destination, you know, my foot, like full masculine, I'll get you there. But it just was this, and that was perfect. It actually was perfect. That's what she needed to say. And it was like, okay, my old style masculine would have been like, I'm freaking
out. What is it?
What is it? Define it. Me. Like, give me the alphabet. Break it down, woman. You know, like, just
let's fix it. Let's solve it. Let's.
If there's an A, I need to define B and really quick. But it's just this paradox. That's the feminine. It's this mysterious and the permission to be completely irrational, nonsensical. Like, the words did not make sense, but she was allowing herself speak them anyway. So I just wanted to share that, just this paradoxical thing. And it's like, it's really a crux for, I know most guys listening in, it's this incredible crux and challenge in a relationship when, especially like, you know, coaching high achieving guys, where what works in corporate, what works in your career, what works as an athlete, what works is like, it's masculine. And it's like, it doesn't work. If that's the only skill set and rule set you have or paradigm you're coming from, there's always going to be this major clash, you know, the thunderstorms of masculine, feminine coming together and not integrating. So yeah, I just want to share that, but your words really brought up the humor of yesterday morning with my queen. Lane, I want to honor you and like the writing of the book. And I think for myself, having read the book, and it's like a part of the essence of the podcast here, I really want to give guys like an introduction to the man behind the book. I find for me, myself personally, when I'm listening to podcasts, there's these podcasts that they're riveting for me and I'm learning about the author himself. And then there's these other ones which are well-meaning and beautiful, but I just never resonate. It's like where you just like, it's almost like the first 5 minutes is chapter one, second 5 is chapter two, three, four, and normally I switch off. So I want to honor you for just gifting fully of yourself. And yet I really want to draw the guy's attention and awareness on Unleash Your Humble Alpha. The guys listening in predominantly, as I mentioned, you know, the title of the podcast, Be the Husband She Brags About. It's like, guys, they're in the arena. They're like yourself, myself. They've predominantly made that sacred choice to commit to one woman. How would you define a man showing up as a humble alpha within the context, as a humble alpha within the arena of marriage? What's the heart essence? What does that man look like on a daily basis? How would you describe his essence?
I would say an essence of integration, and really just mastery and integration of the masculine and feminine within themselves. And what that usually results in is that once you are able to be yourself anywhere and everywhere you go, is not really a matter of you needing to like do a lot of stuff. Is that life is giving you everything that you need, and you have the tools to navigate both the certain things that you are willing to existence and the uncertain things in the world that are seemingly, you know, around you, right? So like the world is sometimes in chaos, right? And sometimes we have situations, you know, within our family dynamic, friends dynamic, and relationship dynamic, they're like, whoa, we didn't see that coming. Like, emergency happens, or injury happens, or drama happens with the family, or something happens, you know, with that's bringing up, you know, trauma within, you know, the husband and wife. And we're like, whoa, I didn't see that coming, you know. And the fully integrated man, the humble alpha, and it's not just for men, you know, humble alpha is for anybody, but integrating the masculine and feminine is definitely one way to put it. But in the context of marriage, it allows you to be exactly what the moment calls for, to allow yourself to, if you need to be the directional leader to give us focus as where we're heading as a family, then I'll be that. I'll do what I need to do. If I need to sit there and listen and not try to solve a problem, I'll be that. If I need to dance between both of those, I can do that because I'm integrated, because I know that I have everything within me to navigate a masculine moment, a feminine moment, and anything in between. So it's allowing yourself to navigate the present moment, no matter what, you know, the world throws at you, and doing so with greater ease, more calmness, yet also still being decisive, you know, as you're moving forward.
I love this thread in the conversation with you, you know, this dichotomy, the certainty and the uncertainty. And it just seems like it's the masculine and the feminine. The masculine in us wants to bring certainty, wants to measure it, wants to set the destination, wants to plan the destination, directionality assigned, yeah, all of that. Beautiful. And it's like, I really want to put it forward to the guys, like, that's sacred. You know, those that sword that you've been sharpening, that's a sacred part of your expression. And then the feminine is that uncertainty. You know, the feminine is the sacred universe, is the changeability, is the changeability of the seasons. And in our women, you know, it's like that changeability, that when your woman is actually allowed to be totally feminine from one moment to the next in conversation and emotionally, it's actually the full embodiment of uncertainty. The incredible wisdom that is coming through, that is just want to reflect back, that my mind is picking up. I know every guy listening in is going to be picking up his own unique things that are jumping out, but it's almost this synthesis of the humble alpha is asking what the moment is asking for. Because I know there's this distinction coming through in me. It's like, for years, it was like what my conditioning was thinking was meant to be done or should be done in the situation. And it's like, oh, you awkward woman, like, what the fuck? Or like, why the hell? It's like, it was my conditioned past telling me these unconscious directives of should and should not. Yet what I'm hearing there is like just this capacity to be, again, you mentioned it several times, the present moment. And it's that breath again from the Green Beret training, you know, breathing in, breathing out the anxiety, the stress, neutralize the situation. And then what's my next action as defined by what's absolutely necessary here and now? There's just such potent wisdom. Like if every guy listening in just brought that into, you know, into life in their everyday from this moment, listening in, going, okay, cool. This super cool guy, Lynn Ballone, I just took that from the conversation. That in itself would be so impactful. Can you speak, this is just a thread from earlier on in the conversation. Can you speak to the importance of identity for men showing up in the arena of marriage? I know you've spoken to it, and in men's work, it's like that in the modern mindset of men, we've been conditioned so much. And I know there's ancient trades in it, you know, the blacksmith, your name went with your job and mastery. So there was a sacred part to it, but definitely that has been, I think, exaggeratedly focused on in modern, since the Industrial Revolution, where it's almost like a man's only identity that's allowed is like we identify with our job, with our mission. And sometimes we can struggle to identify with having a place to lead powerfully at home, you know, as a dad, as a husband, as a lover. Again, within the marriage container, what wisdom do you have to speak to guys listening in on the sacred inner work of identity and how important that is to ground yourself as a man in marriage?
So identity is whatever we decide. And that's actually the first section of our book is, you know, we are what we decide. And what it means is that we're all this very elusive essence that is undefinable. And yet we are living in the human experience. And for the guys listening to this, as a man with a wife, and when you have this perspective of you're a beautiful essence and really sink into what that means. And there's a lot of ways to get to that truth, because everything is pointing towards that. But once you have that as a truth, then you're able to then loosen your grip on role, responsibility, and title. And that allows you to be much more flexible and tap into the feminine of change to be the husband that you want to be, right? So if you loosen up your grips on who you think you are and remember this truth of the essence of who you are, then it automatically has a byproduct that when I'm looking at myself from the perspective of husband, if I look at how I've been and where I want to go, so if I've not maybe been, you know, great at communication, if I haven't been great at just being and letting things happen and without trying to fix it, if I identify that's who I used to be and maybe that's who I am today, I can loosen my grips and say, you know what? I can be a different kind of husband starting in this very moment. And I'm shifting my trajectory of, I want to be there for her. I want to support her in a more profound, beautiful way. I want to do X, Y, Z, right? Or be X, Y, Z. And I can then shift to become the husband that I know that I can be, that I want to express. And, you know, oftentimes we can look at attributes of other husbands and say, oh, that's really cool. Oh, that's really cool. Oh, that's really cool. But like, in some ways you are, you know, from one perspective, you're like, oh, I'm just copying them. But on a much more spiritual level, you are seeing yourself in them, that's what I want to express. That's the kind of husband I want to be, the husband that every once in a while brings this tiny little gift that is, you know, less than $5, but it means so much, right? It's the thoughtfulness behind it. It's not about how much money I could spend on her. You know, it's pulling those things out, because the universe is a mirror. And so if we see husbands like, oh man, that's so cool, I'm a little jealous actually, you know, like that's a reflection of who you are, but you haven't yet quite expressed it. So, you know, looking at other men and their relationships, and if you feel like you're jealous or like, oh man, that's really cool, like that's a mirror. And then just like, okay, now I've identified it, and now I can decide to express that and become that kind of husband versus what I have been. But it all starts from loosening the grips of who you think you are. The experiences that led to this moment have been your story, but the story isn't written because of the past. It's the perspective of the present moment that allows you to shift and say, oh, I can look at this a little differently. And I can actually use all of my challenges, all the great stuff that I've done, examples of other people, and I can bring all of that into my life and be able to then, you know, then be able to move forward, you know, with, you know, life itself.
So Lane, I mean, as I've mentioned, you know, this conversation, I want to keep it going, but we're at that time coming into Sacred Landing, and a profound and beautiful conversation has brought so much value for guys listening in. I'm assuming every single man listening in around the planet is intrigued and curious to know where they can find you, how they can follow up, where can they find you online?
Yeah, so my website, lanebalone.com, has kind of the aggregate of what I'm doing, both with Humble Alpha and other things that I'm up to. That's probably the easiest way to find out, because also I have a podcast that I do called Exactly What the Moment Called For, where I share some really fun stuff, and social media on Facebook. It's Lane Balone. I'll be the only one. On Instagram, that's probably where I hang out the most, is at Increase Freedom. And also on TikTok, I'm experimenting with just kind of more funny stuff. So that's kind of like where I'm aiming to be more playful. So at Increase Freedom on TikTok as well. So yeah, happy to chat with anybody that has any questions or point people in the right direction.
Thank you so much, Lane. And guys, Unleash Your Humble Alpha. I've read it myself, re-listened to it. Just profound wisdom. I know you can get it from Lane, the embodiment and the wisdom coming through, but definitely put it on your checklist for the next book to order. Lane, thank you so much for coming in, gifting so much of your time, attention, and presence here. Really appreciate that, brother.
Thank you, brother. And thanks for creating the space for a beautiful conversation. Mm-hmm. You really cultivated and curated just a beautiful present moment, and I'm grateful.
Thank you, receiving that. Kingly brothers around the planet, the tribe expanding into the outermost reaches of the English-speaking world and beyond. I'm really appreciating your presence, listening in. As always, you know, just bring your mind, focus on the insights that showed up for you, leaning into what Lane was saying there, you know, expand your identity to bring the greatest relevance of those insights as a reflection of your truth. And then find creative ways to implement, you know, simple ways, showing up a little bit more loving, a little bit more caring, you know, asking what the present moment is asking of you, just to echo beautiful wisdom from Lane. Coming into landing, another beautiful conversation. Can't wait to join you another day with another fantastic guest. Ending with the mantra of our movement: the better husbands today, better world tomorrow. Go have an amazing kingly day.